enough to cross, enough to last till the end of time.
We squeezed 5 songs into the Burt Bacharach set, and I hear there might be more to come. Anyhow, we started that set off with the Shirelles doing Baby It's You off of the LP by the same name, Gene Pitney, 24 Hours from Tulsa, off of the LP by the same name. Love the trumpet part on that song, not to mention Dusty Springfield's song, but we're not going to talk too much about the trumpet part. Dionne Warwick after that doing Don't Make Me Over from the Definitive Collection. And then Dusty Springfield with the dropped G song, Wishing and Hoping. I think every line has a dropped G in it. That was from a Greatest Hits compilation. And last but not least, Jackie DeShannon, another great horn part in that song. What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love off of the LP by the same name. That's going to do it for me here. I will be back, God willing, next Friday, 9 p.m. I don't have any idea what I'm doing. Do you know what I'm doing?
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what you're doing.
Okay. Hopefully I'll figure it out before then, but who knows. So you've been listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Take it away, Zombo.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA at WRCT.org.
Hey, it's Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman to talk about banned books on Forbes Avenue, and this is on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The reason I'm talking with Professor Newman about banned books is because you run a banned books class. So how did you end up offering that class?
I don't remember what the initial inspiration was. I think the original title was Censored Texts. But starting about 20, 25 years ago, I just got interested in the phenomenon, and I noticed that it was happening more and more. And then I got interested in the history of it. And every time you poke at a case of book banning, you find something different and you find something interesting. So I taught the class originally. I had like a set of texts that would change, and the students would write papers on what we were reading. And then 6 years ago, I changed to the format I have now, where students do original, in-depth, high-quality research on a single case of book banning. And I found that CMU students really rose to the occasion and did really good work. So I'm enjoying this new format.
What would you say you've learned from having this class?
It is so cool to see what students are interested in. I have students from all over the world, and so a lot of students want to work on books that were banned in their home country. So China, a student came up to me today and said she wanted to do a play that's been banned in Colombia. So I learn about books from all over the world. That's one super cool thing. And then I think students who choose books that have been banned more recently, I've helped students do things like find the video of the school board meeting where the book was banned. And so just getting to see human beings in action doing this thing that we kind of think of as nefarious or behind closed doors, like actually being able to see the school board meeting where it happened is really cool.
So you were talking about the trend that you noticed 25 years ago. Would you say that it still holds? Are we banning more books than we ever have?
I don't remember what I was inspired by 25 years ago exactly, but certainly since 2019, 2020, there has just been like a hockey stick graph. Like it is like right now, I would say is probably the most challenges in American history are happening to books right now. The group that really tracks that is PEN America. They come out with a report every 1 to 2 years. And so they're just showing that there's more and more parts of the country and more kinds of books and more different kinds of people who are challenging books. So I think I came up with the idea for this class, and now it's really more relevant than ever before.
So I know there's a lot of people trying to combat that with social media, online library cards, that kind of thing.
Yes. I think sometime in the last couple of years, maybe the Brooklyn Public Library made it possible for anybody in the country to get a library card there, and then they could get electronic books or audiobooks. So I think, I mean, here, this is one of the ironies. In some ways, information has never been more accessible, more available, cheaper. And so it kind of raises the question, why challenge a book if somebody can just get it some other way? What is the political capital that's being expended to say, I want this book out of this public library, or I want this book out of my kid's curriculum, or I want this book out of my kid's library? So I think the questions are in some ways more vexing now, because it just begs the question. And also, if you hand your 12-year-old a smartphone, why are you also trying to take a book out of that 12-year-old's classroom? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, although people on both sides of the political argument have decided to ban books for various reasons.
Definitely. There's not like one political group that has a monopoly on saying, I don't want my kid to read this book, or I don't want any kids to read this book. But there has been a more easy to track movement from American political conservatives since the Reagan era, and especially in the last 5 years. After Trump lost the 2020 election, there was an attempt by sort of the movement that was around Trump to attack school boards and to sort of take on cultural issues. And so critical race theory, books by diverse authors, books by queer authors, those books really started to come under attack kind of in the wake of that presidential loss.
So one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, beyond this being a great topic, is that we do have Banned Books Week coming up in late September. Do you feel like that celebration helps counteract this push towards book banning, or does it possibly kind of not do enough?
Yeah, there's a real irony that's present in both book banning and book defending. Banned Books Week was the brainchild of a librarian from Pittsburgh. Her name was Judith Krug, and she was she worked for the American Library Association. And she went to the American Booksellers Association and said, you know, we're seeing this uptake in challenges. Why don't we band together and promote the idea that we should have the freedom to read? And so at a big book convention in 1982, there was the first kind of celebration or recognition of banned books. And there's been one every year since 1982. I think the irony is that every year when Banned Books Week comes around, somebody writes an article that says there's no such thing as a banned book in America. And it's true that it's incredibly rare that any governmental agency will ever take action against a book. We don't live in a totalitarian country where you could be jailed for what you write, at least not today. And so there's some irony that the presence of Banned Books Week tends to sort of incite opposition to the use of the term banned books and to the whole kind of, people say it's hysterical, it's sort of pearl clutching, it's much ado about nothing. At the same time, there's another ironic reaction is that oftentimes when a book is targeted and then that target is publicized, that increases sales of the book. So the graphic novel Mouse was challenged by a Tennessee school board in January of 2022. And almost as soon as it was publicly known, that book just started flying off the shelves and they had to print some extra runs. So I think there's just irony on both sides. When you overtly try to defend books, you get attacked for sort of exaggerating the state of book banning. When you attack books, you often inadvertently promote them. There's an action and an opposite reaction that happens in both moves, both challenging and defending.
Given you've been studying banned books and teaching about them for so long, what would you say causes people to challenge them, especially when this causes such a counterswing to the other direction?
I mean, I think the positive that I see in book challenging is that it's a reminder, and a really happy reminder for me, because I'm an English professor, that books are powerful, that books incite strong emotions, that they make people want to do something, even if that thing is to close the book and try to take it away from other people. So I think it's evidence that in this kind of information-saturated world, we still value books and we still find them to be life-changing in a certain way. I think the other thing that I notice is that the internet and social media, I think, has allowed people to organize and exchange information at a much higher rate. So, for example, The Grapes of Wrath was banned by Kern County, California in 1939. And there was like a little 2-inch newspaper squib about it. And that newspaper squib got reprinted on a wire service. And so then a few other county libraries and city libraries took up the challenge and said, yes, we agree. We think Grapes of Wrath is offensive and we're going to ban it. In some cases, there's one library that burned it. They had a ceremonial burning of it. So the newspaper was kind of the viral media of the day. Today, if somebody challenges a book, it's often part of a list that circulates through political groups. There's a conservative political group called Moms for Liberty that has chapters in different states. And then book defenders also are organized on state levels. So there's ACLU chapters in many, many American cities. So I think what I'm noticing is that in some ways, even though it's probably more futile to challenge a book than ever before, people can share information about what books to target and how to attack them. It's easier to share that information than it's ever been in the history of books.
Would you say that graphic novels, for example, you mentioned Mouse, are especially easy to target with this then?
Absolutely. I mean, graphic novels are targeted, you know, I don't remember what the percentage differential is, but it's at a much greater rate than books that just have words on the page. I do think there's a famous judge who said, I don't know what art is versus pornography, but I know it when I see it. So we somehow trust our eyes to tell us if something is offensive or bad or wrong. And that visual information, we believe that we can adjudicate it in a way that we somehow maybe don't feel like we can adjudicate the written word in the same way. So graphic novels are constantly under attack. Anne Frank is a frequently banned book, The Diary of Anne Frank, but the graphic novel of The Diary of Anne Frank, banned and challenged even more. Things having to do with the Holocaust, like Mouse, Diary of Anne Frank, those have really been hot button books in recent years. Other graphic novels that are under attack, genderqueer, coming of age memoir about a non-binary author. The most banned book in America, basically since the day it was published.
You mentioned that Holocaust and queer issues are a hot topic. Is there anything else that tends to be banned?
One of the people that we study in my class is one of the top banned book researchers in the U.S., and her name is Emily Knox. She teaches at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So she's just a fantastic scholar, and she has a wonderful article about how when books get challenged, it tends to be diverse books that get challenged. And what she means by diverse books is books by authors who are considered to have some kind of marginal identity in that moment or in some past historical moment. So books by women, books by African-American authors, books by queer authors, books by Native American authors, Asian American, Indian American, Latino American, those books tend to be the most targeted. And Knox, I don't know if she would call herself a free speech absolutist, but she would really challenge anybody who wants to ban books, because her argument is ultimately if when bans and challenges go forward, they tend to fall on the text written by more marginal authors more than any other kind of author. So you might think, oh, I don't want To Kill a Mockingbird taught because the author used the N-word. But then it turns out that most books that are banned for the use of the N-word are written by African-American authors. So you might think that you have the best intentions when you're trying to get a book out of circulation, but the end result is that the people who get silenced are the people that we really need to hear from the most.
Thank you so much. I'm Riona. I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman talking about banned books. So I wanted to situate banned books in the larger context of free speech. How do banned books and free speech go hand in hand, do you think?
I love that question because I always start the class with the First Amendment. And I think that when students hear the word free speech, and if they haven't had to do AP Gov or, you know, some really intensive civics course, you just think, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. And the First Amendment is 45 words, and not that many of those words are about free speech. And all it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. And that actually isn't very specific and doesn't actually give you the freedom to say whatever you want. It only says that Congress shall make no law. So I really like to think about how kind of weird those 45 words are and how limited they are in terms of what we know how to do with them. One thing that is really shocking to me right now is how many state legislatures are passing laws against books. And the 1619 Project has been banned by at least a dozen state legislatures across the country. So I haven't seen any of those cases go up to the Supreme Court, but I sort of can't believe that we are actually passing laws against books, even despite the First Amendment. And I don't know if a state legislature is, I guess, distinct from Congress, but I honestly just don't understand it, can't figure it out. But I think that the openness, the vagueness, maybe the simplicity of the First Amendment does give us a real opportunity to think about what it means to have free speech and what the American Library Association calls the freedom to read. The ALA has a Reader's Bill of Rights or Library Bill of Rights that I teach in the class, and I can't recite it chapter and verse, but the basic idea is that you have the freedom to receive information. And I think that is much more comprehensive than simply the idea that Congress shall pass no law. Because if I have the freedom to receive information, if you have the freedom to receive information, then we can't be prevented from accessing a book in the library that a librarian has deemed appropriate, or reading a book in a class that a teacher has deemed appropriate. We are free to receive that information. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this political moment is that many people have perceived the conservative party, the Republican Party in America, to be the party of freedom, of liberty. I don't want big government. I don't want to be taxed. I don't want to be told that I can't own or carry a gun. But that movement of liberty and freedom, going into schools and saying, you can't have this book in my child's classroom or in my child's school, seems to be sort of going against this message of freedom that we've been hearing for a long time. So I do think this is an exciting moment to think about what freedom is, freedom to and freedom from. And I think in some ways, the freedom to receive information protects, if that was enshrined in our Constitution, it would protect us from the kinds of bans and challenges we're seeing so frequently right now.
Yeah, it's a really thorny issue, though, because even if Congress doesn't make any law or the government doesn't make any laws, there's still society which can kind of chill free speech. For example, cancel culture.
Yeah, I put cancel culture at the very end of the class and kind of save it for the last week, because I find that 18 to 22-year-olds are pretty comfortable with the idea that we shouldn't be banning and challenging books, but are maybe more interested in canceling as a project. So I try to have us spend the whole semester looking critically at book banning and then thinking about what's the difference and what's the similarity. And I think I study the history of consumer activism, the history of boycotts. So I sort of put canceling a little bit more on the side of consumer culture. I don't want to read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, somebody might say. You know, then you have kind of extreme versions of that where people were destroying their Keurigs sometime in the last few years, because I think Keurig had a progressive advertising message but the idea, like, I'm not going to buy this product because of what the product represents or because of what the author did and I don't agree with it. So I'm okay with consumer activism. I think it's fine. I do find that the accusation that somebody has been canceled tends to be overblown in the sense that a lot of so-called canceled people still have their platforms. I do think it's really interesting when it crosses over into labor. So I think the case I'm thinking of is the case of Amy Cooper, who met an African-American man named Chris Cooper in Central Park. She had her dog with her in an area where you're not supposed to have dogs because it's a bird area. He said, could you please take your dog out of here so I can watch birds? And she videoed him saying that, and she threatened to, she actually did call the police and say, there's an African-American man threatening me in the Ramble. I think that was the name of the area of the park. She was fired from her job. Should people lose their jobs because they were caught being racist and idiotic on social media? I don't know. That's a hard question for me. You do not have free speech at work. 100%. And I think, again, people come into my class thinking, oh, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, wherever I want. Your employer can fire you for what you say. So I do get really interested in kind of the layers and contradictions that come out when you start thinking about the similarities and the differences between banned books and cancel culture.
Taking it back a little closer to banned books, people can also be fired for perhaps giving a child access to a book. So I feel like that also verges onto labor.
It does. Teachers and librarians are just under so much duress right now for being in the public eye around these issues. They are getting threatened with arrest, you know, more kind of garden variety bullying, death threats, digital harassment, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA, organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn, again, for, you know, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a formula. We don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago. So originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective, even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It's lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh is a mistress, a wife, a pen friend, a checkout girl, a complimentary moist lemon-scented cleansing square, or a handy freshen-up white pet. WRCT is the breath of God, the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning sun when you pull from an old bookshelf a forgotten volume of romantic diaries. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party, a creak on the stair, a sputtering match held to a frosted pane, the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking nappy, the hulk of a charred panzer, the underside of a granite boulder, the first downy growth on the upper lip of a Mediterranean girl, cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norworth, your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Asthma affects 25 million people nationwide, and every day 10 people die with it, with African-American women and children being most at risk. Early warning signs include coughing, especially at night, or with exercise and wheezing. Almost all asthma can be effectively managed with a good action plan. So talk with your doctor today, and for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate economic news can be so abstract that it's disinforming even when it's true. The big idea is that there's something called the U.S. economy that can be doing well or poorly, which obscures the reality that we are differently situated. And good news for the stock market, say, may mean nothing or worse for me. A people-centered press corps would spell out the meaning of economic indicators, not just in terms of their impact on different communities, but in relation to where we want to go as a society that has yet to address deep historical and structural harms. A new report on the current state of the Black economy takes up these questions. We'll hear from its co-authors. Deidre Kasante Muhammad is president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Algernon Austin is director of the Race and Economic Justice Program at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That conversation is coming up on today's show. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Corporate news media tend to report economic news like the weather. Yes, it affects different people differently, but the source, the economy, is just stuff that happens. But there's really no such thing as the economy. There are policies and practices about taxes and lending and wages, and they are as historically embedded, preferentially enforced, and as susceptible to intentional change as everything else. So how should we read reports about the best Black economy in decades, particularly as one question news media rarely include in the daily recitation of numbers is compared to what? A new research brief engages these questions. The title's a bit of a giveaway, The Best Black Economy in Generations and Why It Isn't Enough. We're joined now by the brief's co-authors. Deidre Kasante Muhammad is president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Algernon Austin is director of the Race and Economic Justice Program at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Welcome back to Counterspin, Deidre Kasante Muhammad and Algernon Austin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, economic reporting can seem very dry and divorced from life as lived. We read that the country's GDP is up or that inflation is leveling off. And a lot of us just don't know what that means in terms of whether we're more likely to get a job or a wage increase or a home loan. If you can parse that data, though, it does tell us something, if not enough. So let me ask you first, what particular indicators are telling us or showing us that Black Americans are experiencing the most positive economic conditions in generations? What are you looking at?
Well, this is Algernon Austin, and one thing that I pay a lot of attention to is the employment to population ratio, or the employment rate, and that's simply what percent of the population is working. That's something that's very concrete that people can relate to. And for the Black population historically has had a significantly lower employment rate than the white population. So why we're in the greatest economy on record is because if you look at the prime age employment rate, that's individuals 25 to 54-year-olds, the Black prime age employment rate, the annual rate, is at a record high, or at least for the first half of this year, has been at a record high. So that is certainly quite positive news and something that we should celebrate. But as you pointed out, compared to what? Compared to the white prime age employment rate, it's still below average. And when you do the full calculation of what I call the Black jobs deficit, we need about 1.4 million more Black people working to have the same employment rate as white people. And what does that mean in terms of income for Black America? If you had an additional 1.4 million Black people working, you would have an additional $60 billion, that's with a B, $60 billion going into Black America, which would significantly reduce Black poverty and would help Black households start to build wealth. So that's the positive. We have a high employment rate. The negative is it's still lagging and it's still causing a great deal of poverty. That lag, that deficit is still causing a great deal of poverty for Black people.
So, Algernon, you've connected employment and poverty and income right there, which are kind of the key indicators that I'm seeing lifted up in this report. Unemployment is one that is a complicated thing to report because, as we know, sometimes unemployment rates don't include people who've stopped looking for work and all of that. But you're saying that unemployment and poverty and income are all connected here. But what can you tell us about what those other indicators, the poverty rates and the income and wealth indicators, what do they add to this picture about good news?
We pay a lot of attention to the unemployment rate, which is valid. It's an important indicator. But for populations that face persistent challenges finding work, and I just said that the Black population, there are about 1.4 million people, Black people who should be working but who aren't. For populations that face consistent challenges, you see the unemployment rate undercounts joblessness. And it undercounts joblessness because if people have been repeatedly rejected by employers, so imagine someone who maybe was formerly incarcerated. That individual is less likely to be actively looking for work. And if you're not actively looking for work, you're not counted as being unemployed. Or if you're in an economically depressed area and you look around and you say, there are no jobs, and you're not actively looking for work, you're not being counted as unemployed. So the unemployment rate is an important indicator, and the Black rate is typically about twice the white rate. Right now, it's a little bit less than two times, so that's, again, another positive sign. But it does undercount joblessness.
Yeah, and in terms of income and wealth, we've also seen some positive signs, right? So I think that's why we're saying it's the strongest Black economy in generations, because you see in many of the major indicators that Blacks are at record high. Also in terms of median household income, Blacks in 2022, we're at $53,000 median income for our household. And so that is a record high for African-American community, as well as wealth in 2022, where we have the most recent data, is at a record high of $45,000. Now, just as Algernon had noted, record highs can be great, but, you know, relative to what and what does that mean? The median income for a white household is $81,000. So Blacks are still about $30,000 less in terms of median income. And I think most people would understand that $53,000 for a household is not a lot of money. And if we look at wealth, you know, we also argue that $45,000 median wealth is actually a household that is asset poor, that does not have enough wealth to keep them financially secure. There's been estimates, well, let's just put forward that white median wealth is $285,000. Mm-hmm. So you have that $45,000 compared to $285,000. With past estimates of middle class wealth beginning around $170,000. So we can see that we're hitting record highs, but we're still, we meaning African Americans, are still in spaces of economic insecurity. And that's why it isn't enough and we need to do more.
There's been a phenomenon lately where reporters and pundits seem to say, people are saying they're not happy with the economy, but they're wrong. Because look at this chart. You know, it's sort of like people are maybe too dumb to know how good they have it. But people aren't dumb. They know they have two jobs and still struggle. You know, they know they have a fairly good income, but they could not survive one medical emergency. But reporting and some politicking seems to suggest that if you aren't doing well, then maybe that's a you problem, because after all, the economy is firing on all pistons. But people's opinion about their economic health and their economic situation, Black people's opinion, comes from a combination of things, you found, yeah?
A lot of the reporting is based on macroeconomic indicators, which are, you know, I'm not disputing them. It's just that they are not necessarily the big picture national average. Can mask a lot of variation on the ground and can be distant from what people are feeling. So we've been through, because of COVID, because of the lockdowns, because of the shutdown and supply chains, because of the war in Ukraine, we've seen a massive spike in inflation, I think probably more than we've seen in a generation. And that has been quite a shock. And I think that affects people's views of economic conditions. We've also seen very high interest rates, and that makes it very hard for people to borrow or increases the cost of trying to get a mortgage, increases credit card debt. We've seen in terms of housing, a real scarcity in housing and a real spike in housing costs. So there's a lot of things for people to be worried about, to be anxious about. And of course, there was the COVID recession, which was a massive. So there's been a lot of economic turmoil, and it's an error to discount what these recent traumatic experiences are. And the fact that they're not just experiences, they're real economic consequences that people see every day when they go to the grocery store and pay their grocery bills.
And Diedrich, the report says, you know, Black Americans are optimistic, pessimistic, multifaceted and complex in terms of their understanding of their own economic situation. And then when they're asked about the broader picture, and that makes sense as human beings. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I did think that was an interesting thing pulled out of our paper, was looking at some past surveys and seeing 67% of African Americans expressed optimism, feeling good to somewhat good about their financial future. While at the same time, in a different poll, in a Pew poll, we saw that African Americans, about 70%, said they did not have enough money for the life they want. You know, and these are different things, right? Like, again, if you're used to ridiculously high unemployment rates in your community and then it's getting a little bit better, that might make you feel optimistic that, oh, well, maybe things can get better in my household. But at the same time, you can still understand that, you know, but I don't have enough money to be a homeowner. I'm having a harder and harder time paying grocery bills. So like both of those feelings can live within one's life experience and be real. I think it's only when you're trying to just have a very simple explanation of how people feel that we act like they're in contradiction.
Algernon has referred a couple times to consistent challenges faced by Black Americans. I think that's part of what's left out of a lot of news media conversations. So let's just talk about when you say big numbers, macro numbers can be trending in a good direction, but they're not enough and they're not going to be enough without something else. What are you getting at? What would responsive policy look like?
In response to the COVID pandemic, the federal government expanded the child tax credit and expanded the earned income tax credit so that more poor people and more poor people with children would get aid from the federal government. And what did we see? We saw a dramatic decline in poverty, dramatic decline in Black poverty, dramatic decline in Black child poverty, as well as for American Indians, for Latinos, and for the white population. So we know what works. We know that we have the power to do it. But unfortunately, conservatives in Congress decided that they were not going to extend the expanded child tax credit and the expanded EITC. So we've seen a reversal. So we've seen Black poverty rates, and this is using the supplemental poverty measure that factors in these tax credits. We've seen the poverty rates increase again. So it's unfortunate that policymakers don't put the policy agenda to fight poverty and to produce more racial equality as a higher priority.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, you know, I think an important takeaway from this is that though we have some record highs, we don't need to let up on the economy. We need to kind of put our pedal down to the metal, as the saying goes, in order to continue to build and strengthen. Because even with these record highs in terms of income, we noted a report that was done last year with the Institute for Policy Studies that noted that even at the current rate, if you look from 1960s to 2020s, it would take hundreds of years before Blacks had equal pay with whites. And it would take almost 800 years for Blacks to have equal wealth with whites. And so over the last 5 years, we're having some important advances. And so what we need to do is do policies that build off of that, right? Whether it's, you know, continue to strengthen earned income tax credits and other such types of credits. I think increased home ownership, there's a lot of conversation on that. We have to make sure any type of home ownership advancement is something that disproportionately affects African Americans in particular, but Latinos as well. African Americans have never had the majority of their population as homeowners, and that's number one source of wealth for most Americans. So if we can do something in 2025 to really strengthen homeownership of first-time homeowners, that could be something substantial that could help break away from these historic inequalities that have made racial inequality not just something that occurs through prejudice, but something that can be seen through socioeconomic status.
We also need targeted job creation. Subsidized employment is the most effective way. So subsidized employment programs targeted to high unemployment communities. I mentioned that we still need about 1.4 million more Black people working for the Black employment rate to be the same as the white employment rate. So we need to target those high unemployment communities with effective job creation.
When I hear consistent challenges, I mean, we're talking about racism, in terms of economic policy in this country. And the harms have been targeted historically and presently. If I could say redlining, loan denial, all of that, the harms have been targeted. But at this moment, supposedly reforms are not allowed to be targeted because that would be DEI. That would be unfair, And I know we've talked about, for example, the COVID response was not about race. The Great Depression, the WPA, was not targeted by race. It was actually something that helped Black people because it helped everyone. But we're in this present moment that we're in, where if you say these people are being particularly harmed, and so at least some remedy should be targeted towards them, we know that that's going to be politically difficult. And I know that's a weird question, but I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, clearly, racial equality has always been politically difficult,
right,
as the history of this country has shown. So it will continue to be politically difficult. I think we have seen times like the war on poverty that sometimes in its name might not appear was something particularly focused on African-Americans, but it was coming out of the strong Black civil rights movement of that time period when we saw, a substantial decline of Black poverty, in particular all poverty, but many of the policies that did have a disproportionate impact on African-Americans. The most effective and efficient way to address disproportionate negative harm is to then put in positive economic impact, particularly on those communities. So we should look at ways of doing that. Sometimes race would be the factor named, but sometimes you can also get it just by focusing on first-time homeowners of certain income and wealth levels that would disproportionately have a good amount of African Americans, Latinos, and would have some whites, but would have a disproportionate impact on the community. So I think the policymakers are willing, and I think it's our job as the electorate to make policymakers willing. We can get forward these policies, whether we call them DEI policies or whether we call them trying to ensure that America is majority homeowner or America is fully employed throughout the nation. There are ways of putting this forward.
This is a long struggle. So if you look at the history of the Black civil rights movement or Black liberation struggle, however you want to characterize it, there have been moments when we've moved forward. There have been movements when we've moved backwards. So this is just one phase.
Yeah.
So it's important for people to recognize, okay, what's next? How do we move forward from this particular point? So I think it's important to regroup and think about how we move forward. Well, I'm particularly focused on affirmative action policies and particularly affirmative action in employment, which still exists, which needs to be protected and fought for because it will be under attack. The second point that Deidre was making is that there are ways that may be less efficient for racial justice, but there are ways to make impacts that reduce racial inequality. And we saw it going back to poverty. The expansion of the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit had a disproportionate positive impact on reducing Black poverty. It also reduced white poverty and poverty for all other groups, but because more Black people were poor and in hardship, it had a disproportionate benefit. So although that was a race-neutral program, it did have a disproportionate racial benefit. And similarly, I've called for targeted subsidized employment, and I noticed I said targeted to high unemployment communities.
Right.
You can go to Appalachia and find majority white communities that are high unemployment, and we should be concerned about those high unemployment white communities. But if you target job creation to high unemployment communities, you will disproportionately benefit Black communities because that's where the high unemployment is disproportionately concentrated. So I think it's important that we continue on both fronts. Let's exploit all the race-neutral policies that we can, but also let's not give up on a race-conscious economic justice fight in addition.
Well, I just want to ask you finally about news media, about reporting. When, Diedrich, we spoke in 2017, I was talking about a Washington Post piece that said that a rise in middle-class incomes was unequivocally good news, even as the same report had some sort of notes in between, one of which was, oh, yeah, yawning racial disparities remain. And that's kind of par for the course in news, the idea that racial gaps in economic circumstances and options are lamentable, but normal, and kind of a footnote to the real story, which holds an implication that a rising economic tide will eventually lift all boats. And that framing and that absence of complexity, while it's kind of par for the course in corporate journalism, it reflects a misunderstanding and a misrepresentation of the way economic developments affect different groups, which is what we've been talking about. And I wonder from both of you if you have any thoughts about the role that journalism currently plays in illuminating this set of issues and about the role that journalism maybe could play.
Things have changed a lot over the last 30 years, even this idea of racial inequality minority groups. I mean, now you look at Blacks and Latinos oftentimes as well have lower income levels, have lower home ownership levels. And you put these populations together, Blacks and Latino, and they're about a third of the population. And if you talk about youth and children, you see that the majority of kids in many school districts throughout the country are students of color. So no longer can it be kind of, well, there's an issue with a small part of the population, but the rest of the economy is going strong. The future of the economy is based on how well minorities do in America, Latinos being the largest group now, African-Americans being the second largest group. So it will be essential if we're looking at how the economy can grow, making sure these communities are getting their share of the growth that would get them at a level of true middle class. Because I think that's one thing I particularly look at in terms of wealth, is that Black America's never had a strong Black middle class in terms of wealth. You've always had a very small population that have had, middle class economic wealth stability. And, again, the future of reporting on the future of the country really requires understanding those differences and highlighting that so we can push the country in the right direction. And how do we move the country forward in a way that is equitable in a manner that it never has been?
I don't want to appear to be too self-centered or self-serving, but we need the information presented in this report covered, because I feel both parts of the story has not gotten sufficient media attention. One, that we're at historic highs on so many different measures that I don't think has been talked about enough. And two, we still have significant inequality that we haven't addressed. I mean, there are some positive signs, but we obviously need to do a lot more. And like Diedrich said, we need to keep pressing the gas. We can't take our foot off the pedal. So that's one thing. The other thing, and I try to stress this when I speak to people, is that we're talking about the United States. And Black people are part of the United States. Latinos are part of the United States. The American Indian or the indigenous population are sort of part of the United States. Some are independent nations, but they're also interacting with the U.S. economy. If you improve the economic conditions of the Black population, you're improving the economic standing of the United States. If you improve the economic condition of Latinos, you're improving the economic strength and health of the United States. And it's important that people understand that, because unfortunately, people tend to go into a zero-sum mode and not recognize that helping Black people in terms of public policy is a way to help the entire country, help the United States. So that's something that I think reporters can also work on communicating.
The one thing I'll add in terms of, what can reporters do is, I think reporters need to focus in on expertise, Black expertise around racial inequality, put forward as a recently new president of Joint Center for Political Economic Study, it's important that Black institutions are utilized and are put at the forefront of conversations around the economy and these issues. You know, it's great that there's been more conversations around racial wealth divide and race and economics. There's been a lot of conversation around DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion movement and attacks on it. But I don't feel that they have enough centered on those who have been at the forefront of highlighting these issues, putting forth policy solutions to address them. There are cadre of reporters who have been focused on these issues for the last 20 years. And these reporters need to be at the forefront of the conversation. Oftentimes, if I do get a call, I'm getting a call from someone who's reporting this for the first time, doesn't even quite understand the reality that there is deep economic inequality. It has been ongoing, and it would take radical change to really get us to a place where we could have some equity, some equality. So again, I think, you know, we need to value those who have been focused on this area and those institutions from these communities if we really want to report correctly on these challenges.
We've been speaking with Deidre Kasante Muhammad, president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and with Algernon Austin, director of the Race and Economic Justice Program at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The brief we've been discussing can be found at both jointcenter.org and CEPR.net. Thank you both so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can learn more about FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Music history. Welcome to Cruising the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decade, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
Come with me now for an exploration of music history, past, present, and future. This is episode number 115, CruisingTheDecades.com. I'm Brad Savage, and on today's program, a member of Traffic other than Steve Winwood goes solo in 1970 and will freak out with the Mothers of Invention. Joy Division's 1980 Inspiration, a song later covered by Nine Inch Nails, and Early Blues from Bessie Smith and the Piano of Fletcher Henderson. This is Cruising the Decades, and we're going to start at the birthplace of it all. One of the earliest successful band leaders, W.C. Handy, out of Memphis, Tennessee. William Christopher Handy is known as the father of the blues. While he was not the first to play blues music, he was the first to actively publish music of the blues form and really brought it to a new level of popularity. This is the roots of blues and jazz and pop. It's all right here over 100 years ago in 1917. This is Handy's Orchestra of Memphis, and it's Columbia Records 1917. It's called Sweet Child. on Cruisin' the Decades.